Welcome to pod 40 of the official Palace pod. I'm Chris Grierson from Palace TV, which you can watch on the internet. And if you're listening to a podcast, you know how to use the internet, so I'm sure you can find it nice and easily. Right, what have we got on today's pod? Well, today's pod is less small bitty things and more longer form, more big things on this one. Just three big things. Roy Hodgson's press conference. We've got Doc Brown. We haven't got Statman this week. He is back from his middle-class jaunt to Japan to watch the Rugby World Cup final. But we just couldn't match up availability to meet face-to-face. Could have done it over the phone, but it wouldn't have been great. So we haven't got that today, but we have got two really good long interviews and then Roy Hodgson's press conference, as always. But the first one is club legend Mark Bright. I'm sure you've seen because he's done loads of media this week. He's been on BBC Breakfast, Good Morning Britain, Five Live to promote his new book, which is called My Story. I've read bits of it and it looks amazing. It looks like a really interesting one that isn't just about football. It's also it's mainly about him going from foster care to become a footballer. And I had absolutely no idea what he'd been through in his life. We sat down earlier this week to have a little chat about writing the book, but he ended up talking about lots of things that are in it. And it was quite emotional. Here is Mark Bright. Mark, whenever something decent happens in football, a good story, everyone always says, oh, I'll put that one in the book. What made you feel that this was the right time for you to write a book?
I suppose, really, looking at Cyril Regis Ugoekiog, Gerald Samuel, you know, passing away before their time. Just thinking that the time was right for my son, rather than sit there and try and tell him about my backstory, write a book and let him sit and read it at his leisure when he's ready.
And when did the process start?
Oh God, ages ago. I'd planned to write a book sort of the last season of my career in 1999 when I was at Charlton. And there was too many diaries came out, so I'd tried to do like a diary thing. So I did, 20,000-30,000 words. And then I just left it. And then I put something down for myself just on some subjects I'd like to talk about if I wrote a book again. And I started writing some on those subjects, some funnies, some things that had happened in my career. And then, Kevin Brennan, who used to work for the South London Press, and I used to do a column with him in the South London Press, a weekly column. He approached me and just said, oh, I've been speaking to publishers. They asked if you'd be interested in doing a book. It's like really strange. So I didn't think I could do it justice to write myself. I think, you know, obviously it's a skill in writing. I can do articles and things like that, but a book was a bit too much for me. So, yeah, so he said he would do it. We sat and had conversations. So you're going back over a year. And we used to FaceTime each other and he'd give me the subjects in advance and then we'd sit and talk about those subjects. So sometimes you have to try and find out about things and go back and see what you could remember. But, you know, the best thing for myself is we were in care. So my brother and myself went to the social services, this was a couple of years ago, and got all our files. And it's really harrowing. Yourselves, if you grow up with your parents, you just, whatever they tell you, when you were five, you used to do this, this and this. With us, it's all there. It's all logged. It's all, you know, when you went out, what you did, where you went, who you were with. It's really strange reading so far back, all details, and it was handwritten and in ink. Really nice. So the process has been quite long, and then, you know, now it's here. You know, it just seemed, they said, we want it for sort of like next, for November. You're thinking, oh my God, it's like a year away. But it creeps up on you, and now it's about to be launched.
So all that stuff when you can't quite remember what happened, do you speak to other people who were there at the time?
Yeah, my brother obviously is a year older, and my sister's a year older than my brother. So they had quite a good recollection, but it's about what I can remember, really. My recollection of some things are quite vivid, and then other things are quite sort of scratchy, sort of like, my brother say, can't you remember him? And I'd say no. Like, for instance, a girl at Tracy Cook, and she's living in Australia. She's been in Australia for 30 years, and she sent me an email, sent me a message on Facebook, just saying, "Oh my God, Matt, I just seen you doing a book. I hope it goes well. Da da da. I'm here. Been here. I've got two kids. They're grown up. My husband's passed away, etc." So I haven't spoke to her since we left school. And so other people on Facebook and that sort of thing get in touch with you and say good luck with the book and everything. But I had to go back and some things jumped out at me. Like in the book, I do this story about Mr. Arkell. And he was the sort of like woodwork or metalwork and geography teacher, something like that. And he had a bit of time to kill at the end of one class. And he said, right, go around the room. What are you going to do when you leave school? What are you going to do? You're about 16 years of age. You know, I'm going to be a mechanic, so like my dad. Oh, good boy. Yeah, I'm a hairdresser like my mum. Yeah, well done. Right, sir, what are you going to do when you leave school? Footballer, sir. Everyone started laughing. So you can imagine he's saying, right, come on, stop it. What are you going to do? I'm going to be a footballer, sir. What's plan B? I don't know, sir. What is plan B? You tell me. What? So he just said, stay behind. He didn't like my cockiness anyway. And then he just said, right, Mark, you've got to think about this. You know, how many people become footballers? How difficult is it? You know, what? I said, no, I'll be all right. So I'll be fine. And then he told me a story about what he wanted to be a doctor. And he wasn't clever enough, so he had to be a teacher. And I said, oh, unlucky, sir, never mind. And he just went, you know what? Off you go, son. And I just closed the door behind me, didn't think anything else of it. And then obviously 10 years later, I'm in the change rooms at Wembley in the FA Cup final against Man United. And there's all these telegrams, yellow envelopes stacked by everyone's places, and you just open and go through them. Amazing. I mean, he wrote to me, just said, I'll be the proudest man in Stoke-on-Trent. Yeah, go and be a winner. So it's poignant moments, really. I think I understood, I got it when I was there, and they invited me back to the school to do a chat, and I just said, look, I didn't work hard enough. I was a bit lazy. I just used to sit there and dream of being a footballer. I said, if I had my chance to do it all over again, I'd work harder. I said, don't make my mistake. And the headmaster said, did I ask you to say that? I said, no, because I did. I regret it. I used to mess about at school. I just thought, I'll be a footballer, I'll be okay. And I realised how lucky I was. So, so I always kept that memory and sort of like hard work. And just like, don't let yourself down. It was, you know, there was things installed in me from foster parents, the people we were with the longest, Mr. and Mrs. Davis. So yeah, it's a long journey, a tough journey, but you know, as I always say, it's worth it in the end.
And was it quite emotional looking back and remembering stuff? Was it stuff that you didn't realise you'd feel emotional about it until you started talking about it with the author?
Yeah, definitely. All comes out. It's really strange. I think not so much. I don't want anyone to feel sorry for me. I don't want it. It's not about that. It's just about. Just it's a journey. You know, everybody's got a backstory. Everybody. It's just a journey, and this is my journey. And I kind of wanted to. I wanted to sit down with my son and just say, look, it wasn't easy for me. I feel like he's been a silver spoon child. You know, great holidays, parents have good jobs, you know, wears nice clothes, we have nice cars, lived in a nice house. You know, all those luxuries, all those things that I never had as a child. So I just want him to understand how privileged and lucky I think he feels he is, you know, and his mum and dad are around him all the time. I didn't have a mum and dad. They were there, but then I wasn't with them. I was in care. I was with somebody else, taking up somebody else's responsibility. So it was tough going, looking back and reliving the memories, but, you know, it sort of like, it shot my focus a little bit to, you know, do you want to put this in the book? Is it going to look good? Is it going to look good for my sisters? Is it going to, you know, all those things. And in the end, you just have to tell your story and be honest, you know, and it will upset somebody somewhere along the line, but that's how it was for us. It was quite tough.
And do you feel like this book will be not so much a football book, like it's a bit of a crossover,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
you're hoping
it is,
to inspire
yeah.
other people that are in foster care.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, you know, make the impossible possible. I mean, that's what a friend texted me. He said, I've just been reading some of the extracts and things like that. I never knew, Mark, I never knew. And it's like somebody in football who I've played against for years and you end up sort of like being friends. And he just said, wow, Mark, I've just read, you know, the extracts in the paper. And he said, you know, it's an inspiration for other kids in care. You know, the people who maybe are told it, listen, you know, just finish school and try and get yourself a job, do something with your life. You know, that, you know, the impossible is possible. Work hard, have a dream, go for it. Whatever you want to do, be the best at it, because the best at whatever they do are the best paid. So if you're the best cameraman, you're working on the best shows. You know, if you're the best interviewer, you have your own show. You know, if you're the best driver, you're driving at Formula One. If you're the best mechanic, you're working in Formula One. So whatever you do, the best hairdresser, Nicky Clark, etc., you earn fortune. So try and be the best that you can be. Set your target and don't let anybody tell you can't do it, you can't achieve it. I mean, I kind of held back on doing a Northbury because I thought there's no real big ending, sort of like FA Cup final win. Picture me, they're holding the FA Cup final, FA Cup or the League Cup, or, you know, something big where you think that's the journey's culminated in this, you know. But does it have to finish it with that? Isn't the journey part of the success of getting somewhere and achieving something, having a dream as a young person that I wanted to be a footballer and being lucky enough to achieve the dream? And through all what happened, you know, that I come and watch the kids play on Saturday mornings or Sundays sometimes, and you see all the parents down the side cheering them on, and you know, I never had that. Never had it. Nobody came cheering me on. My brother was there. That was it. My sister came. My sister used to come in when I was a bit older. That parental guidance, that, you know, the pride, this feeling, you doing something, achieving something, it was all missing. So you have to somehow find the spirit and the fight to go out and achieve it on your own. And that's the key thing. It's in the book about how hard I had to work. I had a job, getting up and being at work at 6 o'clock in the morning, finishing at three, going on the bus to get to Port Vale, and then working for an hour or so in the gym with John Rudge. And it was hard. It was really hard for me. I was tired all the time, but it was a means to an end. I wanted to be a footballer, and nothing was going to stop me.
And do you ever talk about, because obviously you're head of under 23 development here, when you're chatting to the younger players when they're struggling?
No.
Do you ever talk about your upbringing?
Can you think of anything? It'd be a bit much, you know, sitting there telling, you know, what I had to go through. You know, if they did the PLP, Premier League Productions, did a short documentary on me, about 20, 25 minutes. And, you know, in that, you just say everything I said in the book. And, you know, I don't feel like it's my position to sit and preach to anybody. If somebody wants to read the book and any of the youngsters want to read it and just see how tough it's been for me. You know, it was difficult then. And in an era where, you know, there wasn't a lot of people of colour playing football, so you had to work harder because it's, oh, they don't like the cold, they don't like this, they don't like physicality, they don't like tackling. You know, it was all those things. So you had to felt like you had to be better than, your teammates to have a chance. So, you know, it is hard. It is hard. It's hard to be a footballer, full stop. Never mind, you know, being a little black kid in the 70s and early 80s, trying to get into a team.
Is it hard? trying to word my answer here.
Your question?
You're doing the answers.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've seen in the news at the moment a lot about the problems with racism at the England game, but it's in this country as well. Still.
Yeah, yeah.
Has it? Do you feel like it's come back, or do you feel like it's always been there?
Well, as I told you, it took 10 months or so to write the book. We started off with those subjects, those topics, you know, and we covered racism quite early, and then you submit it, you know. And the publishers just got in touch with us not long ago and said, this feels like it's out of date. We're going to have to rewrite that bit because Raheem Sterling, what he did with Phil Foden and the other young black kid from Man City, when they both bought their mum's houses and one was... you know, how great it is, and the other one was blingy, showing off flash because, you know, I hadn't played in the first team. And Raheem Sterling brought that to the fore and just said, you know, look at this, this is wrong, how we're reporting this. And he sort of single-handedly changed perception, didn't he? How, you know, changed views and how the papers write things or present things to us. And little did they realise it's a racist way that they do it. You know, if a black guy wears a chain, it's blingy. If a white one, but, you know, oh, he can afford it. Or, you know, it's just the comparison. So we had to rewrite that section on racism. I just thought it was better when I did the piece that the players can go out now, go out for a warm-up and nobody's making monkey chants or throwing bananas at them, you know, as it happened in our day. People think you're exaggerating, but you just have to ask anyone who's of the age of our age who was a supporter and a fan, you know, like people like yourselves and that, Chris, you're too young, but it did get a lot better. Kick Racism Out of Football, you know, the FA did a great job, everybody did, the authorities, the teams, the football clubs, the supporters did great jobs, got, you know, questioned people in the stands if they started shouting it, just said, no, I don't want it, you know, reported them, got people banned from stadiums. It's all come back again. And I think it's come back mainly because of social media. You know, there's a story in the book about how I just got a message on Facebook one night, you mahogany, Black Sea, because your ancestors sleeping with monkeys, that's why there's AIDS. It's like, you know, and I saved it. Saved it for a couple of years on a Word document. And then Stan Collymore, I think, charged or got the police involved in a kid who racially abused him. And he got sentenced, like a 3-month sentence or something. And I went and looked for the Word document and I found it. And I found the guy's like contact detail and I sent him a message. I said, I saved that message you sent to me. What do you think I should do with it? And he deleted his Twitter account straight away. But then I sent him a message on Facebook. I said, I still know where you are. I know where you work. There's a picture of his missus and kids. And, you know, I'm really sorry. I was drunk. And he copied his mate and his mate was giving me some as well. So I had a chance to take it all the way, go to the police and everything like that. And I thought this could ruin his life, could lose his job, might lose his relationship. You know, I didn't feel I wanted to do that. I just wanted to show him that, I won't say I had the power to do it, but just that you can't say those things anymore. You know, you've got to be more responsible. So hopefully he never did it again, because I stopped short of going to the police.
But on the positive points in the book, football-wise, the positive. What did you enjoy chatting about from your football days and writing about? Sorry, you're a writer.
Yeah, just, you know, the FA Cup final, first one in 1990. I think, obviously, I was lucky to go to two. I went to 1992-93 with Sheffield Wednesday. The first one, though, was just magical. It's just a magical journey, you know, beating Liverpool in the semi-final, getting to Wembley in the final, all the experiences that you hope you'd experience, you know, experiencing those things, the lead up to the game itself, you know, Wrighty coming off the bench, scoring two, almost winning it, and then having to go to a replay, which we lose and let ourselves down, and kind of always you just think, you know what, if I had a chance to go back and replay that game, this is what I'd do. But it is what it is. It's, you know, there's a winner and a loser, and it's hard. When in 2016, when we got there and Punch scored, I'm not one of those people who thinks, I don't want another group to do well because they'll take all the accolades away from anything like what we achieved or anything like that. I was desperate for them to get a winner's medal. And they would then become the team, you know, 2016, the FA Cup winners, and they'll come back and do dinners and things. It'd be great for the club to be their first trophy, and that's the team. And years to come, people go, who's that, Grandad? Who's that? And they'll name all the players. I wanted them to experience that, and unfortunately, you know, we couldn't quite pull it off again. But, you know, there were so many good things as well. You know, I had some great times growing up. Even though we were in care, we still had great times going away. Good foster parents, career things. There's just loads of stuff in there. There's loads of stuff we had to leave out as well, because you just find there's no room. You know, there's no room. I don't know. I think when I was writing, I always used to think, or speaking, I used to think, when my son's finished that chapter, I wonder what he'll think. You know. There's a section where my brother and me moved to a new area, new foster parents, new school. And on the way home from school, we had to run because we had to go down this path that took us to the lollipop lady to cross the road. And we knew if we got to the lollipop lady, we were safe. And my brother said, hold my hand and just don't stop, don't look up. Put your hand on your head and run. I had to run a gauntlet, people throwing stones and bricks at us, because two little black kids, and they were unique in the school. Nobody'd seen any black kids before. And then I could still remember that. I could remember that part of it. I mean, imagine how scarred you must be that you remember that when you're 5 or 6. It's not very far. You just got to run like 50, 60 yards to get to the lollipop lady, and then you're just safe. mean, I don't know how long it happened for. It wasn't long. Foster grandma, she heard about it. The lollipop lady told her. She came up to school the next day. We just died. I'm just like, oh my goodness. Everyone's going to think we're telling tales and all that. We, you know, headmaster stood on the stage, said, you know, things are going on at this school, not acceptable. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. See these two kids here? They've got to be treated the same as everybody else. That stops now what's been happening, and you know what I'm talking about. I mean, imagine that I'm 5 or 6 years of age and I can kind of remember what he said. He never said anything about why. He just flitted round it. And like our foster grandma was sitting there as well. She's thinking, oh no, everyone's gonna, what's gonna happen to us? And kind of stopped. Kind of stopped. Sport was a great breaking down barrier sort of thing for me, because when people saw how good I was at football and things, everyone wanted you on their team. So we want him on our team. That, so then you kind of become like the hard guy in the school who's picking the team. You're on my side. No, he's on mine. No, he's on mine. And people fighting over you. And then you kind of became more acceptable because you're good at something. And so I found that, you know, sport, football in particular, broke down barriers for me. But in sport, at school, I was good at everything. You know, the teacher would say, you know, on my report, it said at 5 or 6 years of age, this is in the social services logs, it said a budding athlete if I've ever seen one. And my brother saw that and he phoned me, said, have you seen what it says on this page, blah, 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 blah. And I flipped through it and found it. So obviously you have to show certain tendencies at a young age for somebody at that early age at 5 or 6, saying a budding athlete.
Do you have a special bond with your brother then? Because
yeah.
I guess you didn't. So you didn't grow up in a black family, did you?
No, white family, white working foster, class.
So
yeah.
It was just you and your brother.
Yeah, my three sisters stayed with our mum. Our mum and dad split up when they were young. There's one story where our mum says, right, I've got to go to a wedding. Can you have the kids? And I'll come and get them Sunday. So our dad says, yeah, so he has us. She doesn't come Sunday, so he walks us over to where she used to live, and there's a note on the door. Said, I'm done. It's your turn. You got to look after him. I'm off. Me? Who does that? Yeah. When I read it, it was just desperate. I mean, what do you do? Yeah. So they took us off him and took us off our dad and put us in care. Obviously, he's working and can't do anything. And then our mum took Marie, our oldest sister, back. So she stayed with our mum, and my brother and me went in care. Went out to our maternal gran. She had us first, not for long though, she couldn't cope. Back into care, then out to the second gran, stayed there for 5 years. And then we didn't really go back into care. We kind of went from there to the next foster parents. I suppose when I look back at it, I think I learned how not to be a bad dad. You know, I think that was the lesson. I thought if I have kids, and I feel like I probably will have kids, I know exactly, I'll smother them, you know, with love and that. And you let them get away with things that you know are wrong and you shouldn't let them get away with, but you kind of do. Because I had a strict upbringing, quite firm. And I wasn't too strict with my son. I was kind of like a little bit loose, like just happy to make sure he had a great... When he grew up, I wanted him to say, oh, I used to do great times with my dad. We used to go to football, used to go here, go to the BBC, go everywhere, just make sure, just wanted him to enjoy it. I took, at 2006, he's an Arsenal fan and his mum's an Arsenal fan, so I said, if they ever get to a final, I'll take you. So they got to the Champions League final in Paris, Barcelona. So we get tickets, struggled to get tickets, flights and everything. And was it Lehman got sent off? Lehman got sent off straight away or something. So anyway, my son starts crying, he said, I can't win. I said, how do you know? He said, can't win. I said, you don't give up, you have to keep trying. And then when I asked him, can you remember going to the Champions League final in 2006? He said, no. No. The biggest event happening in his life, couldn't remember. Yet I could remember running down that school path with my brother holding hands, praying, didn't get hit by a brick or something. I could remember that. And I could remember being at school. I could remember being captain of the team. I've got a great picture where I'm sitting in the middle with the ball between my feet and everyone's got a Stoke City strip on and school team, and And the picture went up on Facebook, and like I sort of like went, oh my goodness. And then we started naming all the people on it. It's unbelievable. So I don't know. Big things have to happen in your life for the future. Remember them, you know. I can remember my uncle driving like a lunatic, and we used to slide across the back seat. Three of us like sliding from one side of the seat, so it's going round corners like, go on, Uncle Granville, go on. You know, I can remember all those things, and like my son can't remember nothing. So I don't know. It's, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I suppose less happened to us. There's more live TV. There was only one game live in the old days. It was the FA Cup final. That's why it was so special to us. The only live game all season. You know, probably the European Championship as well. But we used to look forward to that one day of the FA Cup final from start to finish. Mm. And how when you got in it, how you knew how special it was because you'd watched all those years from the morning time, the trip to, you know, on the player's coach, going there, players being interviewed, articles about them, you know, little short video clips of the striker and the goalie. And it was just a day. It was the day of the FA Cup. So, you know, I know it's a proud moment to walk out in one, definitely. You know, because, you know, you've got so many players, I think, Gordon Banks, I think George Best, have never played in an FA Cup final. So he says, you're privileged, and so you cherish those moments. So, you know, I can remember watching them on TV. So, you know, for my son to turn around and say, no, I can't remember going to the Champions League final. You know, it's a showcase, it's an event. But he's got more going on in his life, no doubt.
So when's he going to read the book?
Sent a copy to him. He got some early copies. Posted them off to my sisters. They'll go. They've gone yesterday, I think. Today? They've gone today. Mother will get one. Just get a chance to have a quick read and scan through it. No, I hope that people just read it and just say, do you know what? I've got an idea of, you know, it's not always been easy, but like I said, it's been worth it.
Mark Abraham Bright there, and if you do want to buy his book, you can buy it from the Crystal Palace Club Shop. You can get it online as well at shop.cpfc.co.uk, and I think it is £20. Yes, I'm looking at it now on the internet. It's £20 there. Mark Bright, My Story. I'm definitely going to be reading that myself. Moving on to someone different to Mark Bright, Doc Brown, real name Ben Bailey Smith, actor, comedian, rapper. You probably know him from David Brent's Life on the Road and Equality Street. He was also in Give Out Girls, loads of TV. Look him up, he's a really funny guy. Obviously, he did the Glad All Over Again as well for the FA Cup final back in 2016. Massive Palace fan. I chatted to him recently because we were getting him to record something for an in-house video, but also we got him to voice the new announcements for VAR in the stadium. When the decisions go to VAR, we haven't had many... VAR. Oh yeah, we had this discussion with him, I think, whether it's VAR or VAR. A lot more people saying VAR now since we recorded it, but I think we decided to go with VAR. We can always change that. Anyway, I'm waffling on. Here is Ben Bailey Smith. So Ben, it's been 2.5 years.
Yeah, we were just saying off air the last time we crossed paths was the unveiling of the shirt for, was it Allardyce's second season?
Well, it would have been. It would have been, yeah, but it was the season that was De Boer's first season. The one with
That seems like eons ago now, because so much happened in such a short space of time from a Palace fan perspective. I mean, it will always stay dear to me for one reason, because on that day, you gave me a shirt with no sponsor on it. we were also having a little word about sponsors before we went on air, but the less said, the better, but I treasure that shirt. It's just beautiful. I mean, that's how football shirts
are
really supposed to look. To this day, I always prefer the kids' kits to the adult kits because they've either got less annoying sponsors or no sponsors at all, you know, and international kits because it's just like, yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, so, did you wear it?
I do, yeah. I haven't been playing for a while, but if I was in a five-a-side, I tend to stick it on because, you know, people will say wear black or white. It's always really boring. But if you wear red and blue, you're just going to stand out. So everyone's going to know which team you're on regardless. But I don't get to wear it that often. More often than not, I'm wearing, like, the evil sash, or another sash one. I can't remember what season it's from. It's a white one. Another with the GAC sponsor on it. It was a Nike.
Yeah,
I wear those two quite a lot for football because, like I say, people just, there's a lack of imagination at the grassroots.
Are there any Palace kits that you wish you had?
Yeah, there's an evil sash. When I say evil sash, for those that are uninitiated, it's a black kit with the red and blue sash across it. There's that one with no sponsor somewhere that I would kill for. I really love that top. I noticed there's been a little resurgence of the bumblebee yellow and black, but I've no idea why.
I don't know if you could buy that one. Could you?
I've seen a few pop up recently, really? And the guys at Old Football Shirts are the sort of dons of all that rare stuff. But yeah, I think probably that black one with the sash, no sponsor, is probably my dream shirt. I've probably got about 20 tops now. It's getting a bit weird.
It's kind of a bit of a pop culture thing now, isn't it?
Like, yeah, totally. I mean, the ones that mean more to me are the ones that obviously I bought in the season. You know, I love my TDK one from, I think, 94, 95. When I was like a very skinny sort of 15-year-old, but you just couldn't get like a medium then was like you could use it as a tent at a festival. Do you know what I mean?
It's so billowy. Past the elbows, yeah, aren't it? Yeah,
long sleeves, really wide. But TDK was such a cool sponsor to have, and the Adidas stripes as well is a rarity on a Palace kit. So I really love that top. I've got one from my friend Saji Burton, who was in my class at school.
Oh yeah, I remember him.
Who played for us for a little while. He brought me one recently of a season he played with, the whole team from that year signed. So that's quite a nice treasure. And if Clinton Morrison's listening, he still owes me a shirt. Been about 4 years now he's promised me one.
What was that from? Did you play with him in a game?
If we played in a game or we met at a thing, maybe it was Soccer AM or something like that, and we'd got chatting and he said, oh, let me get you a shirt. And he totally forgot, obviously. And then he WhatsApped me like a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year message. One of those ones that's blatantly like a cut and paste you send to everyone in your phone book. And I just WhatsApped him back saying, where's my shirt? And then he texts back saying, ah, don't worry, I got you. And then the next message I got from him was the following year, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all friends and family. I text him again, bro, where's my shirt? And he goes, it's been a mad year. Don't worry. He goes, what's your address? So I texted my address. I was like, safe, man. Did like a laughing face, whatever, no hard feelings. Next text I got from him, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. All the best for the year to come. It's gone on for 4 years.
You see, what
now I just screenshot them and
done.
Send them to him.
He should have sent you a Christmas card in the post when he had your address.
Yeah, that would have been beautiful.
Yeah, with no shirt.
So, yeah, that's ongoing.
So away from Palace, obviously, when we did that shirt, we used your song because you had an album out.
What have you been up to since then? Yeah, that was a nice little break. I just took a break from acting and writing, and also crucially I'd taken a break from stand-up because that was the thing I was doing most of the time, and I just found it really like eating into the other things that I wanted to do. It's like clashing with a lot of the writing and the acting. So after that album and I'd taken a break from everything just to do music, I thought, okay, boom, let me just put stand-up down for a bit and see what happens if I really put my mind to the acting and writing. And so after I saw you, I think I went on to do a number of shows all in a row. I did this thing with Sheridan Smith called Cleaning Up for ITV. It was like a 6-part drama. I jumped straight from that onto Doctor Who, and straight from that onto a thing called Britannia for Sky, which is a big sort of sprawling Roman Empire epic. Mm. Lots of swashbuckling and swords and shields. From that onto a thing called The Split for BBC One. It's about divorce lawyers. And now I'm here. Yeah, just finished on The Split and have gone right back into my screenwriting, which is going surprisingly well. I usually write and then it just sort of fizzles out, you know, and developing stuff can be really, really difficult. But as I start to get a few more successes here and there, I think people are starting to take it more seriously in the industry, so it's becoming a bit more viable. But those last two shows I did, The Split, it's going to start in the new year, and Britannia's going to kick off in November 2019. So look out for those as the next things you see my actual face in.
So how far ahead do you plan with your career?
I have to plan pretty far ahead. I don't like to plan too far ahead because I get bored easy and I think, oh, God, if I'm doing this in 2021, I'm just going to be really bored of it. But if I get a role like in something like Britannia, which is like a huge, it's like 8 or 9 months, you know, I have to start looking to the point that that ends. I might be able to deliver this script that so-and-so was interested in at that point. I certainly can't take on any live engagements because I'm going to be shooting long hours in a specific location. So I say it's probably, I think sort of 9 to 12 months in advance, and not that much more than that. And I always factor in a summer holiday now because I never used to do that. I used to always just go to Edinburgh. But then my wife started getting quite upset about So yeah, there's always a holiday.
What about, where'd you go? You got kids?
I got kids. We go to France quite a lot. Got some family on my wife's side that's got a little place in the centre of France. It's really rural. It's a lovely little break and, you know, no tourists. It's just really quiet. It's a good time to recuperate. But next summer we're going to Long Island, see my brother-in-law's got a place out there on the water with a little pier, a little jetty, you know, so I'm really looking forward to that. It tends to be either New York or France. That's purely because of family and because I'm a cheapskate, so always looking for somewhere I can stay for no extra cost.
Yeah, fair enough. Right, let's talk about, back to football, VAR, because we've had you recording some, VAR announcements for the stadium, or yeah. VAR. Is it VAR or VAR? We don't know.
I don't know. I mean, it's referred to by everyone, pundits, as both, isn't it? As VAR, as VAR, as VAR, as VAR. But, you know, I think it's important to call it VAR just so you remember what it is. It's a video-assisted referee. It's actually a group of people with a group of videos making a human decision. So, you know, when we used to always see tragic managers afterwards, people like Steve Bruce, a few years ago, going, yeah, we just need the technology. It's so obvious. We need the technology. The referees need help. Now we've got that. But it's funny because we've been asking for this technology for so long. But actually, it's not really technology. It's just cameras. It's what we had before, but with more chefs.
Yes, more eyes. Yeah, yeah, you're right.
And so, as has already been seen, you can still have huge human malfunctions. I mean, I've seen penalties. Absolute clear cut. And I've just gone, How has that been seen from a million angles and not been a penalty? I'm not talking about Palace. I just in various games.
It's because of the way the
a couple of absolute stinkers I've seen.
Yes, I think it's because of the way the Premier League decided to. They didn't want to interfere as much because we went to Stockley Park to have a presentation of it and we got to see how they do it all. And it's because they have to say that the ref has missed something or seen something wrong.
Right. So if we see a blatant penalty, but when the player goes down, the ref does that sort of arms crossed no thing.
Yeah.
That's enough to the video referees to go, yeah, he's seen it. He's not interested.
No, they'll look at it, but he'll say on his microphone, no, that's not a penalty because like he was already going down. Or yeah, I think there was.
But they can still overturn
I think there was
that,
contact,
no?
But maybe not enough for him to go down. They can overturn it if they say, oh no, if they. I don't know. If it's
and can the ref still go, nah, you're wrong. I'm not going for a check.
He can, yeah. Premier League, they've decided to go with the decision in Stockley
Park.
But other clubs,
think,
they have the screen that pops up. The Premier League don't want that to pop up as much.
Yeah, I think screening too much stuff could create dramas, you know. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I've sat a few rows back from Steve Parrish and Mark Bright a couple times. And they've got little screens.
They're big screens now.
Are they bigger?
Yeah.
See, that I think it's risky because I've noticed looking around, like I was doing it straight away. I was like I'm sure that was a foul. No, he was onside. I was having a little look. But then I noticed like people even further away, like get up and like crane their heads around. And the thing about the screen thing is it's almost better, just talking about crowd safety and stuff and atmosphere, it's almost better not to know for sure, you know, and just be angry, be upset, but you can't be that justified in it. So it eventually it dissipates. I mean, how many times have you been watching a game live, seen something, you're like, that was definitely a penalty, and then you're screwing, you're so angry, and you get home, watch Match of the Day, and you're like, actually, it wasn't a penalty. So I was completely wrong.
Is that what fans, do you think fans enjoy that then?
I don't know if they enjoy it. I just think if you showed every contentious decision, you would be provoking some dangerous reactions, I think, from people who, if you feel angry and then you've got immediate justification for that anger and it feels like an injustice, I think at that point things can spill over. Whereas if you feel angry, you feel it's an injustice, but you're not 100% sure, after a while you can't really keep arguing. You've just got to get on with the game.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably healthier for fans, even though I do think fans deserve to know what's going on, which is why this announcement thing, I think, at least makes it a little bit clearer.
Yeah, but the interesting one for me will be, it hasn't happened yet, but on the penalty, so if a player dives and the ref gives a penalty and then it goes back to VAR and they show that it's not a penalty, as part of the procedure, it comes on the screen, it will say checking penalty, decision, no penalty, and then it will play a replay on the big screen of the player diving.
Yeah, you see, that kind of stuff I think is risky because that directly affects the game, the atmosphere of the crowd, in a way that, I mean, it might turn a game in an unnatural way. This is for me, this is the scariest thing about VAR altogether. The fact that it is changing the very nature, like the fabric of football, that freaks me out. Like the celebrations being called back, the time incursions, crucially the way it sort of pulls a lot of the heart of the entertainment from the game. You know, VAR has come in to check 10 goals this season in the Premier League at the time of recording, and of those 10 they've disallowed 9 and given 1, you know, which was a penalty. So from a neutral point of view, you're missing fun. Like, fun's gone. That's 9 goals are fun. Like, let's not forget that football is an entertainment. So that's probably my biggest central concern about VAR. But yeah, like that penalty situation you're describing, you show a replay of the guy diving. Not obviously diving's not right, but then the crowd are on his back from that point on. Even maybe his own fans are going, "You idiot, why did you dive? Why didn't you stay on your feet?" And that's going to affect his mentality, the rest of his game. I tell you, it all feels a little bit unnatural.
It'll be interesting to see if it stops people diving.
Yes, I think that's where it can be really positive. Like in the World Cup, which seems like a very different VAR to the VAR that we've got, they said, right, from the start, any pulling on corners is a penalty. And everyone's like, yeah, they always say that. And then there was like 20 penalties in the World Cup for exactly that. And it snuffed it out. So, you know,
it's a consistency. Shame, 'cause with Luka Milivojevic, we were looking forward to a few more penalties.
Yeah. All the fans want is the consistency, so that it can say, well, it was to be fair, it was like that last week. Last week it went for us, this week it went for the other team. But we don't really get that, and that's what annoys people.
Okay. Well, I guess the only thing, playing devil's advocate, from the positive point of view, is that one of the things people were most worried about was that they wouldn't have anything to debate.
Yeah, there's so much more to debate.
Exactly.
Now. There's like the very soul of football is at stake here, you know. Like, football, the reason so many people love it, maybe it's not the reason, but it's definitely one of the reasons, is it's so simple. It's such a free-flowing, simple game. Ten outfield players, you know, and a goalie. 11 men or 11 women against each other, just running at each other, trying to boot a round thing into a net. That's it. And so it captures the imagination of so many people. And sometimes with all these new things, you feel like you're overcomplicating it. Like you're trying to sort of rethink the wheel, you know, and it doesn't necessarily need all those things. One huge positive, of course, is you're never going to get a Thierry Henry against Ireland situation, you know.
Yeah, and that was massive.
That those kind of things can't ever happen again.
Yeah,
which I think is super positive.
Yeah,
because you know they can change entire eras for clubs. You know, one of the beautiful things about looking back at football is this sort of sliding doors imagination that you can have. Like sometimes I think about 1990 and how close we were to beating Man United. But if we beat Man United, so many things could have happened. It's impossible to say.
Well,
but
Alex
if
Ferguson.
We did, Ferguson might have got sacked and United weren't in great shape anyway, they might have become an average club who didn't go on to win that much.
Mm.
We would have gone into the Cup Winners' Cup. We might have had a good run in it. Who knows? We might have come back into the league with supreme confidence and finished really high up, you know, and then it reinvested and been ready for when they turned it into the Premier League 2 years later. Instead, what happened? We lost, you know, sank down, and on the birth of the new Premier League, we got relegated and Man United won it.
Mm.
And you can't really... You'd be a fool. Those events were so close to that FA Cup. And this is when the FA Cup really, really meant something. You can't completely separate the two. They were winners on that day. We were losers. And there was something of that we carried through the summer into the next season. And those two clubs just went in completely different directions. And, you know, I love that sliding doors element to football. But it is nice with the VAR thing that if there's a huge injustice in one of those situations, it's not going to stand. You know what I mean?
Mm.
It's going to be dealt with. That puts me at some ease. But, yeah, the amount of, like, original vibe, just entertainment it sort of takes away from, I think, yeah, it's quite a sacrifice to have to make for that justice.
Mm. You mentioned Man United. As we record this, because they're playing tonight,
mm.
we're above them in the league.
Yeah, which is lovely to see. It makes that Wolves game even more irritating, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think we'd be third.
Yeah.
You know, which is at this stage of the season, we you know, we traditionally have quite poor starts and we've been inconsistent. But, yeah, it is lovely to see us high up. It's lovely to see us against above Man United. And it's lovely to see Man United Arsenal relegated to like a Monday night kind of whatever. Yeah. These guys might win. I don't know. Who cares? That's amazing that that's happened. I mean, a couple of weeks ago when Man United got done by West Ham, it was like halfway down the billing on Match of the Day. And it's just like, oh, yeah, West Ham beat Man U. Anyway, moving on. Brighton, you know. And I was just like, this is incredible how the mighty have fallen.
Hmm.
That would have been like first up on Match of the Day a few years ago. West Ham, 2-0. Man United didn't get a sniff. So, yeah, I shouldn't revel in other teams' bad times, but you know, when you've had as many years of bad times as we have, it's just quite nice to see those who don't normally suffer or those who have such a tenuous relationship with suffering finally getting a little piece of it, you know, because obviously there's Man United and Arsenal fans who are, you know, 25 years old and they've never experienced true trauma.
Mm, really. As you said before, try being Palace.
Yeah, trauma is our middle name. So it's a really interesting time for Palace, man, because every game you watch, you just think a 20-goal a season striker, even a 12 to 15-goal kind of striker, would transform us.
Hmm.
Because we look like, obviously, we're prone to certain mistakes and this, that, and third, and we are who we are and we are where we are, but we look like a team that knows what it's doing. The scariest part as a supporter is when you go and watch your team and you're like, I don't know if anyone knows what the plan is. I don't know if any of these players are fit to execute those plans. It's like, we know how to play against most opposition. We don't always get it right, but we know what to do. We know when to attack. We know when to sit deep. We know when to give over possession and we know when to try and keep the ball. Not that we do that well, but we try, you know. We know when to counterattack. And that's just great to see. It's just a shame we don't have someone at the moment. I mean, we potentially do, but they're not producing in terms of, you know, Connor and Christian. But yeah, just that's someone to just turn those chances into goals. That transforms our season overnight, I think.
And just to finish off in the last 5 minutes, normally I get people to do something like this in advance, but I just want to see how your brain works as you think about it. If you were going to create a five-a-side team of Palace players since you've been a fan?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'd have Nigel Martin in goal, most definitely. I'd probably have Eric Young and Aaron Wan-Bissaka. So you had like this guy, like a sort of none shall pass type dude who doesn't really care about moving around the pitch. And then you've got another guy who can defend, but is going to get you goals in a five-a-side, set him up and maybe score him. And then,
Never thought of Wan-Bissaka.
Yeah, I'd love. I think he's so great. Even in the midst of this terrible run Man United are on, Man United fans love him. They look unscathed by it. They're heroes. Martin, Wan-Bissaka, Eric Young, Ian Wright up top, and then who would I have in there? I guess it'd have to be Zaha.
It's not a bad team.
Do you know what I mean? It's five aside, so you don't really need to defend. Just have Eric Young sitting there. Nigel Martin making himself big. And then you've got Wan-Bissaka, Wright, and Zaha just creating mayhem.
Yeah. And a super sub?
Super sub. Oh. I'd probably have John Salako. Just because I love John Salako.
Yeah, he was my favourite.
He was my favourite player as a kid. Just always creating, whipping balls in and falling over. There's always just something really heroic about that. Mm. I used to love when I started playing 11s when I was, you know, I was about 9 or 10, just like taking it all the way as far wide as I could and then just whipping across it and falling over and hoping that someone got their head on it. There's just something about the glory of that I absolutely loved. Yeah. Yeah, that I think that'd be a great five-a-side team. I feel positive about Palace at the moment. I really do. And I think I'm looking at Leicester, who are looking at that power vacuum above them. And I'm looking at what that means for us, because Wolves and Watford have fallen off. And I think there's a vacuum there that's got our name written all over it. That sort of seventh, eighth spot, which has always been a little bit out of our reach.
Yeah,
you know, without getting ahead of myself. Yeah, I'm looking at Everton, I'm looking at Wolves, I'm looking at Watford and thinking, are these that much better than us? You know, in the same way that Leicester are looking at Arsenal and Man United and thinking, hold on, we're decent here. You know,
yeah.
Everyone wants our players. Yeah, if we can strengthen up, keep hold of what we've got, there's no reason we can't compete with the likes of Everton, Wolves and Watford for that kind of spot, which would be a step up for us. You know, that's what I'm excited for this season.
Me too. Brilliant. Thanks so much for chatting to us.
No
and
worries.
Good luck with everything you've got coming up.
Cheers, mate.
Ben Bailey-Smith there, a.k.a. Doc Brown. So that's two really nice, long, lengthy interviews on this week's pod. A little bit different. I'm sure we'll be back with Statman and a few more bitty things next time. But to finish off this 40th podcast from the official Crystal Palace podcast provider, me, it's Roy Hodgson.
Afternoon, Roy. 300 Premier League games. What's your impression of that? Does anything stand out to you over that amount of time?
No, it's surprising how quickly you sort of mount those games up, really. I hadn't given it too much thought before being told that Saturday will be the 300th one, but that's a very nice milestone, I think. It's not easy to get to 300 appearances as a footballer or 300 games as a coach, so I'm proud of that, of course, but I'm also hoping to sort of push that number forward in the future.
Is there anything in particular that sort of stands out to you over the course of that time, Premier League specifically?
Well, so many memories, really. I mean, obviously coming back from Inter to Blackburn was a big step and a big moment, and we started extremely well, had a very good season, that first season. So obviously you remember that, you'll remember the times at Fulham, of course, and West Brom, which went very well for me, and the times here. So basically speaking, it's full of good memories, and there were so many games you could single out, of course, but I'm pretty certain that whatever game I single out, when I go away and think about it, I'll think of another one or an even better one. So I prefer to think of it as a body of work in the Premier League, with clubs that I've really enjoyed working for and players that I've enjoyed working with. So I hope that I'll look back on the time as a global achievement and as a global sense of satisfaction, rather than trying to pinpoint a game here or a game there with each of the clubs.
With matters on the team, how's everyone doing fitness-wise? Is there any updates this week that changed?
Well, we're very fortunate. You know, the players that have been suffering from injuries have now recovered, and one or two people who maybe suffered from a knock, either from the Arsenal game or from the game at the weekend against Leicester, they've recovered. So for the first time in a very long time, I have a completely full contingent to choose from. And have an abundance of riches, if you like, when picking the 11 and the substitutes for the Chelsea game.
I mean, that's particularly important given the run of games that you're on at the moment, isn't it? Sort of big team after big team. Has that been tricky to prepare for, knowing that it's sort of that relentless, I suppose?
Well, the trickiness comes, of course, with the thought or with the realisation that it's not going to be easy to get points from the games or to win the games, because the team you're playing against is above you in the table and is more highly rated than perhaps you are. But the good thing is that you've never lost a game until the referee blows his final whistle, and certainly we don't go into games with a particular lack of confidence in ourselves or a particular lack of belief that we can bring about a good result by playing well. But obviously there are periods of time within a season where there will be a run of games where you perhaps meet the teams who are regarded as the top teams one after the other, and you just have to prepare for that mentally and accept that and not get too downhearted if, like the game against Man City or the game against Leicester, you don't actually win it. As long as you can feel satisfied that the performances that the team is giving are still very much good enough and still good enough to lead you to victories.
Gary Cahill's coming up against his former club. I know perhaps sometimes in the media we can make more of these sorts of things than is necessarily the case, but he was very well liked at Chelsea and perhaps felt that he could have stayed and done a job there. Will he have a point to prove, to your mind, do you think?
I would like to think not, because I mean his record at Chelsea is quite incredible. I mean, he's won the Champions League, he's won the Europa League, he's twice won the Premier League, he's twice won the FA Cup, he's won the League Cup. I mean, that's just off the top of my head. I mean, I'm pretty certain if I look into his record, it'll be even more than that. And he's played up to about 300 odd games as well. So I don't think players who've been such good servants to their team and have done so much for their team and have really written themselves into the annals of the football club as a true legend of the club, I don't ever think they've got anything to prove. Whether he regrets, you know, not having his contract renewed, that's a question only he can answer. We, of course, are very fortunate and very happy that he didn't get his contract renewed, because it opened the door for us and we were able to get him to play for us now. But he's still a very good player. He's still, in my opinion, one of the best centre-backs around in this league. And, of course, the fact that he both played so many games for England and captained England is another thing with his palmarès that I'm sure he'll take with him to the end of his career.
Word on Chelsea, how impressed have you been with them this season, despite the youth, and of course, how impressed have you been with Frank Lampard, who, of course, you've managed before?
He's done a very good job, there's no question of that. The club has done a good job in encouraging the manager and his staff to blood some of the players that previously have been out more on loan than playing actually within their parent club. So I think everyone at the club deserves a pat on the back for that. And I'm certain that Frank will be more than happy with the way the team has started, the way the team has played, and where they find themselves, both in the Premier League and in the Champions League. It's happy days for him at the moment, and he deserves that, I'm sure. I've always had an awful lot of respect for Frank as a player, and I'm pretty certain that he will make certain that the football world has equally as much respect for him as a manager the longer his career goes on.
Great, thank you very much.
Roy, how great is it for British managers? You've got the likes of yourself, Frank Lampard and Chris Wilder doing so well this season.
Well, I must say, I've never looked at the league in terms of who's British or who's English and who's Spanish, etc. As far as I'm concerned, you know, we are a European league played on English soil, so it's had less of an effect on me than maybe it has sometimes with the mass media, who like to sort of look at these sort of facts, if you like, and look at these situations. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm just pleased for all managers who take the job on and do well at the job and get the accolades that perhaps their work deserves. I can easily identify with them and I'm very quick to congratulate them all. But I don't personally like to see the league divided into, well, who's British and who's foreign. As far as I'm concerned, it's a very much a world league, and English people are fortunate that it's played on their soil.
Chelsea's record in the league's been good this season, but their away form's actually been better than their home form. So are you seeing it as a real opportunity to take 3 points?
Well, I can only give you the stock answer to that. We see every game as an opportunity to take 3 points, basically. And again, those type of anomalies that are thrown up, if you like, during the course of a season, they never have a great effect upon me. We look at Chelsea, the team. We look at Chelsea, the players within that team. We look at Chelsea, the style of play, and the problems that's likely to cause. We look at Chelsea and try to analyse if there's any areas which we, with our players and with our play, can exploit. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, what's happened in the season so far, whether they won more at home, more away, you know, they're interesting statistics, I'm sure, for people to read, but they don't have any bearing, if you like, on my approach to the game.
Do you see keeping Tammy Abraham quiet as half the battle tomorrow when you consider how good he's been so far this season?
Well, if it was just keeping one player quiet, then I would feel a lot more confident going in the game than I do, knowing that there are a lot of players to keep quiet there. But Abraham, who's waited patiently for his chance to show how good he can be for his parent club, he's had several loans and has gone out on those loans and has obviously forged a reputation there as well. I'm certain for him, he must be delighted to be now back and getting the credit and the applause that he's getting playing for Chelsea, because Chelsea, of course, is the club that he joined as a young lad and has been a major factor in his development as a player.
Just finally for me, there was a lot of excitement when Max Meyer joined the club nearly a year or so ago. Is it fair to say we've not seen the best of him so far?
Well, that's not so much his fault. He works hard in every day in training, but you know, he faces competition from other players, and he faces the fact that I have to choose what I think are the best 11 to win the game. And certainly recently, he's not been featuring in that situation. But the thing about your comment, you know, players come, all players, when they join clubs, join with a great excitement. And also, of course, they come completely as unknowns, you know. So, you know, for people outside of Germany, when you announce Max Meyer, yeah, people get excited by that because they've never seen him play and they don't really know anything at all about him. So I think that every new player, when he comes to a club, is likely to be greeted with, you know, fanfares and delight and enjoyment and everyone expecting wonderful things from them. But sometimes the way things pan out, it doesn't go quite that way. And the one thing all new players have to do when they come to the club is to make certain they displace the people who are already there. And in our case, they're trying to displace people who, over the last 2 years, as far as I'm concerned, have done an excellent job for this club.
Okay, thank you. Nigel, Frank hasn't got a lot of experience as a manager. Are you surprised how well he's done at Chelsea?
No, not at all. I expected it. I think that when he and Steven Gerrard went into management, I had no doubts that they would succeed. For me, it was a question, were they going to go to a club which would give them a chance to really show that they are great management material and more than capable of doing the job? And fortunately for Steve choosing Glasgow Rangers and for Frank choosing first Derby County and now Chelsea, they've obviously chosen wisely. The people who've employed them know what they're employing and believe in them. So for me, there is no surprise at all.
And do you see Frank as a future England manager?
There's no reason why not, of course, but I must say it's a question that hasn't crossed my mind, and I'm pretty certain that at the moment both Steve Gerrard at Rangers and Frank Lampard at Chelsea are not waking up every morning wondering when the call's going to come to manage England. I think they're probably perfectly satisfied with the way their career's progressing. But they've both been fantastic servants for England. They both earned 100 caps playing for England, and that's not a bad thing to have on your CV if you want to be an England manager.
You mentioned Gary Cahill's record. What does he bring to the squad off the field?
He brings his experience, of course. He brings his tranquility, his serenity, his enormous confidence in his ability to do the job and knowing what the job actually is. And when I say what the job is, I'm not just talking about the 90 minutes on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. I'm talking about Monday to Saturday, Sunday, and all the work has to go on out there in terms of the preparation. He's a quiet leader in the sense that he doesn't go around attempting to make himself extra important or making his voice heard above everybody else's. But what he does do in every training session and every game, he shows people around him what this job is about. If you want to be a top-class centre-back, this is what you have to do. And, of course, that's what we signed him for. We brought him to the club so that he would make us better in that area of the field, and fortunately he's done that.
Before the Arsenal game, I don't think you'd conceded a goal from a set piece. Two against Arsenal, the opener against Leicester. How much of a concern is that?
Every goal is a concern, of course, but the fact is, you know, there was loads of time in the period when you're referring to when we didn't concede from set plays, when we could so easily have done so. Balls that just whizzed over the crossbar, shots missed, opportunities missed by the opponents, great saves from the goalkeeper. Then suddenly you come to a couple of games where it doesn't work quite that way and you let goals in. It's, I think that for me to really start discussing and considering our performance from set plays, I'll wait until about the middle of May and then I'll look at it. And, you know, you have to bear in mind that it's a question of how many set plays you face. And in that opening 20 minutes against Arsenal, they started like a house on fire. They had about 7 or 8 or 9 corner kicks. We've played games where, you know, the opposing team had only had a couple of corner kicks. So there's so many factors. You know, it's too simplistic just to say, 8 games there you didn't concede, 3 games there you have, what's gone wrong? You'd have to look at the number of corner kicks you faced in those first 8 games, the number of corner kicks you faced in these 3, etc., etc., etc. I think I've made my point.